that's the stuff that sticks in there.
Join me, Ophira Eisenberg, for NPR's Guiltiest and Most Puzzling Pleasure.
Saturday morning at 11 on AM 580.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We want to go back to a story we've been covering because it continues. It's about practices by healthcare facilities for veterans. More than 24 healthcare facilities run by the Department of Veterans Affairs are being investigated for allegedly creating secret patient waiting lists as a way to hide how long veterans were really waiting for care. President Obama talked about the issue this week, vowing to get answers, but he also said that if misconduct occurred, it will be punished.
My attitude is, for folks who've been fighting on the battlefield, they should not have to fight a bureaucracy at home to get the care that they've earned.
We've heard from reporters covering the story, but we wanted to hear from someone who's had a close connection with health care for service members, so we called Representative Tammy Duckworth. She is an Iraq War veteran, a former Black Hawk helicopter pilot who lost both of her legs and partial use of her arm during an attack and spent a year recovering at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. She also formerly served as an Assistant Secretary of Veterans Affairs, where she worked on initiatives to improve communications and end homelessness and better serve Native American and women veterans. She is a congresswoman representing Illinois, and we reached her at her office on Capitol Hill. Congresswoman, thanks so much for joining us once again.
It's great to be on. Thank you.
So as we mentioned, you formerly worked for the Department of Veterans Affairs. When these allegations surfaced, I'm wondering if there had ever been scuttlebutt around this. You know, sometimes there's an issue, but there's kind of a whiff of an issue, and people have heard about it, but there's been no proof so that they don't know how seriously to take it. When you were serving at the agency, was there ever any suggestion that this was going on?
Well, when I was serving at the agency, what happened was Secretary Shinseki helped put into place the new standard that veterans would not wait more than 14 days for an appointment. This was a new system with the electronic record keeping and also the electronic scheduling system that was put into place. And so the new system was supposed to be one that was electronic that would automatically send updates and then report as to how long patients were waiting for their appointments. And so this whole people gaming the system to get around the system, especially at the expense of veterans, is absolutely news to me, and I'm just appalled by it.
Oh, I was going to ask you that. How did you hear about this, and what was your reaction when you heard?
Oh, I heard about it in the news, like everyone else. You know, my reaction was twofold. One was just disgust, and I'm worried about veterans who are not getting the care that they need. And now I'm worried about the veterans who, watching the news the last several weeks, think that they won't get the care they need from VA, so don't even bother going or don't even bother trying. And then we simply can't have that. Our veterans need the help, and the services are there. But on the other hand, I have to say, having worked in the VA, it's a large bureaucracy. It's the second largest department in the United States government, and there are problems with bureaucracies that large. That's why we need to streamline them, cut them down, make them more efficient and more responsive to the customer. And in this case, the customer is the veteran. So I wasn't surprised that it was happening, in the sense that when you run that many facilities, something is going to happen. But I was absolutely disgusted and appalled.
I was going to ask if you have an operating theory about how this could have happened. You've previously said that the VA is like, that there are silos, you know, there are two main elements, the Health Administration and the Benefits Administration, and that they don't effectively work together. Do you have a theory about how this happened or why this happened, just based on your knowledge of how the place works?
Well, the VA is still very much siloed. There's actually three different administrations within the Department of Veterans Affairs. And the two that are most critical here that have the problems are the Benefits Administration that provides the pension payments, the GI Bill benefits, the VA home loan guarantee. And then there's the Health Administration that does all of the hospitals and clinics. And they're very siloed, and they don't like to talk to each other, and they don't even like to talk to the leadership at the central office. And I was very frustrated because I got the sense that folks who were the heads of the regional offices, their loyalty was to their silo and not to the entire agency. And I really feel like their loyalty should be to the veterans first and foremost. And that means that they should be sharing information.
Is this a function of people in the field not being able to speak with or have any control over the circumstances that would make a difference? Because you have to assume that people don't go to work every day trying to do a bad job, right? So is it because they don't have any ability to be heard if they can't meet the workload or what else? I mean, is it just bigness?
I think it's more the resistance to change. I think it's mixed messages going out to people who are on the front lines. So in this case in Phoenix, it appears that it's the hospital leadership that's telling their middle managers and their schedulers to create this alternate record-keeping system so that they would not have to report the true wait times for veterans to the central office in Washington. And I think it's unfortunately and absolutely criminal. It's self-preservation, and those folks need to be punished. You know, the answer should have been, gosh, we can't get veterans in within the 14-day period. Let's report that to headquarters so that they know we need more resources, right? We need more doctors, we need more clinics, we need more facilities so that veterans don't have to wait the 14 days, or we need to start approving some of the requests for veterans to get health care outside the VA but paid for by VA if we can't get them in the 14 days.
Yeah, well, why didn't they do that? I mean, are there incentives to lie? Because as you pointed out, there is that option of referring people outside of the system, but they didn't seem to do that, at least according to the facts as we know them now. So why wouldn't they?
Well, this is what I want to find out, because in the vast majority of VA facilities, they do refer them. I for example, go to VA for my women's health clinic and the amputee clinic, but my VA can't meet on a timely basis and to the level of sophistication my needs for the type of high-tech prosthesis of artificial legs. So I actually receive my artificial limbs from a healthcare provider that is connected to the University of Illinois in Chicago, and they do some cutting-edge research, and the VA pays for it. So I'm sort of one of those people that are hybrid. I go there to VA for most everything else, but when it comes to my limbs, because they can't meet my need on a timely basis, they pay for me to go outside. And that's the way it should be. And it seems like in some of these hospitals that they were not willing to do that, and we need to figure out why. And if it was a matter of a hospital director who wanted to protect her end-of-year bonus because she wanted to report the very best numbers, even though they were not true, then that's criminal, because especially we found out that veterans died or were harmed in any way. And I'm going to make sure that we continue to put the pressure on and this type of practice.
I do have to say, just in the spirit of fairness, that the reporting doesn't yet indicate or confirm that the 40 veterans who died while on waiting lists, that the mm-hmm. fact that they died was due to the wait. So I think that is one of those issues that does remain open for clarification. But on just on the whole question of accountability, there are those who have said that Secretary Shinseki should resign, former four-star general, that he should be held accountable, not because he started the problem, but because he's been in office so long that he now owns the problem. Do you have an opinion about that?
I think he does own the problem. And I think now that he knows that there is a problem, in this case, that he needs to fix it. I want to find out from the audits, first and foremost, how many hospitals, how many clinics are doing this? How widespread is it? First it was one clinic, then it was seven. Now it seems to be maybe over a dozen. And I want to know exactly how widespread it is.
But it sounds to me as though you're saying you don't think that Secretary Shinseki should resign at this point. Is there a
Not
tipping
at this
point
time.
At which you feel that he should? Is there something that would cause you to lose confidence in his ability to fix this?
Well, if he knew about the delays and the duplicate records keeping system and did nothing, then that would give me great pause. But right now I want to know who knew and how widespread is it.
Well, the VA said yesterday that it was 26 facilities where this practice seems to have occurred. Do you have a reaction to that number? I mean, obviously one is too many, but what do you feel about that?
That's 20% of the major facilities. Hmm. That's unacceptable.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about this whole issue involving the allegedly secret patient waiting list involving Veterans Affairs healthcare facilities. I'm speaking with Congresswoman Tammy Duckworth. She's a Democrat who represents a district in Illinois, but she's a former Black Hawk helicopter pilot who's been served by the VA when she lost her legs while serving as an Army helicopter pilot during the war in Iraq, and is a former Veterans Administration official. Before we let you go, I just wanted to ask about a couple of other projects that you were involved in while you were at the VA, which was to better address the needs of women service members and veterans. And also, you're currently working on legislation to extend maternity leave for women currently serving in the military from 6 weeks to 12 weeks. How are those projects going? I mean, do you feel confident that you're making progress there, or is all this being overshadowed by this current issue?
Well, we are making progress on both. By the time when I first got to VA, there was not a women's coordinator or women's representative at every VA facility. And I made sure before I left that there were, especially at all of the major hospitals. And then my next push while I was there, every time I visited a hospital, and I said, I want to see your women's health coordinator. And then when I went to that particular office, I asked how many of these women who work here are veterans themselves. So my next push was not only to have them a women's center in every hospital, but to make sure that there was at least one female veteran working there. As far as the MOM Act, I'm so proud of that because we, in just a few days since I introduced it, have had over 70 co-sponsors, both Republicans and Democrats. And what this bill would do would be to give military women 6 additional weeks of maternity leave. Right now, they only get 6. Civilian women and federal employees get 12 weeks under Family Medical Leave Act. But
those are unpaid, though, are they not?
They're not paid, right. The FMLA does not apply to military women. So the additional 6 weeks that this bill would give military women would also be unpaid. And unfortunately, that was a consideration that had to be put into place. I would rather it was paid, but under the current budget constraints, at least having the option for the 6 additional weeks will make a big difference for women in the military. And this is, you know, so that they can choose to use it. If they choose to go back to work at 6 weeks, then that's fine. But if their family and their child and they need more time, then they should be able to do that. And frankly, military commanders were getting frustrated because many of the commanders wanted to give their female service members more time after having a child, especially if they'd had a cesarean section, for example. But the way the regulations were set up, they didn't even have that option.
Congresswoman Tammy Duckworth is a Democrat. She represents Illinois. She is an Iraq War veteran, a lieutenant colonel in the Illinois Army National Guard. So thank you for your continued service, Congresswoman, on all levels. And we reached her at her office in Washington, D.C. Thank you again, and we hope we'll speak again.
Thank you. Look forward to it.
Coming up, juveniles in Tennessee can get caught up in the web of the criminal justice system, sometimes for actions that aren't really crimes. We'll find out how a cigarette behind the bleachers could lead to time behind bars. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. In the new film Words and Pictures, Clive Owen stars as a prep school English teacher who uses an unusual challenge to try to save his job.
You pick a subject, paint a picture, we print it in the issue. I write 1,000 words on the same subject. We have an assembly. Words versus pictures, which is worth more?
Clive Owen, next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays, starting at noon on AM 580.
3 months worth of rainfall in the Balkans in just 3 days, and the floods are unprecedented.
It looks like hell. We are so shocked. Imagine seeing a building and you can only see from the 5th floor to the top. Rescuers out there are in their boats, literally cruising between the roofs.
How the locals are coping with this extreme weather disaster. I'm Steve Kerwood, and that's next time on Living on Earth from PRI.
Saturday evenings at 7 on AM 580.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We're going to spend this part of the program talking about our criminal justice system and how it treats some of the country's most vulnerable citizens. In a few minutes, we'll hear from NPR's Joe Shapiro about his series called Guilty and Charged. It's about fees and penalties that more and more states are charging poor defendants. And he describes how these fees are not only keeping already poor people in poverty, in some cases, those fees are sending people behind bars. But first, we're going to focus on how some of the youngest defendants can get locked up without benefit of counsel, often for things that aren't technically crimes. In Knox County, Tennessee, teenagers who are caught with cigarettes or skipping school can find themselves in handcuffs, facing steep fines, and even criminal records, all without being represented by counsel. Joining us to talk about this is Susan Ferris. She wrote about the issue for the Center for Public Integrity, and she's with us now. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You say that many of these kids are brought into the system because of something called status offenses. These are things that would not be crimes if they were adults. Can you tell us more about that?
That's right. Status offenses are really only committed by children. They are truancy. In most states, that's a status offense, not a full-blown delinquency. Running away, tobacco possession, in some states, alcohol possession, violating curfew.
Tell us about one young girl that you profiled for your piece.
We spoke with a girl we identified as AG. She's a young woman now. She was 15 years old, and she was accused of truancy. This was a girl who suffered bullying at school and was going through a lot of personal problems. She had a lot of conflict with her family, refusing to go to school in the morning, and she was eventually, her name was referred for prosecution to the district attorney's office. She showed up in court for her court date with her mother, and she did not have an attorney. Her parents didn't even think of doing that. She pled guilty, and the judge had her jailed immediately from court. So she spent a night in a detention center. She was shackled and taken in, had to put on a uniform, spent the night in a cell. And the next morning, her parents were told to take her to school, and she had deteriorated so much emotionally, they instead took her to a doctor, and she ended up in a psychiatric facility for about a week.
Your reporting suggests that these kids routinely go through this and are locked up or plead guilty to offenses without the benefit of legal counsel. Most people who've seen cop shows have seen, you know, you've got the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. You have the right, you know, and if you can't afford counsel, it will be appointed for you. You're saying that that doesn't apply in juvenile court?
Well, this is a really good question. It does apply in juvenile court for crimes. But when kids are accused of status offenses, when they first go into court, they have no constitutional right to the appointment of counsel. In other words, if they can afford to hire an attorney, they can bring that attorney with them, or if they have access to a pro bono counsel. And states vary. Some states have taken steps to require that these kids be appointed counsel before they enter a plea. But there is no constitutional right.
You pointed out there was one courtroom where the local attorneys had even offered to set up a kind of a pro bono program. Local attorneys would volunteer to assist these kids in these circumstances, and the judge said no.
That's correct. In Knox County, Tennessee, a group of attorneys, some of them affiliated with the University of Tennessee, and some local business attorneys offered to set up a pro bono service at the court, in the court lobby, for example, where as children arrive for hearings on truancy with their parents, these attorneys could offer to, for free, represent them or advise them. And the judge chose not to grant permission for that project to set up.
He's never explained that.
The explanation I received from some of the attorneys who tried to personally persuade him was that he didn't think that there was a really serious need for these kids to have counsel from the beginning in court. Now, the law is eventually, if these children go back to court because they continue to commit truancy or they're put on probation and they violate it, and when they get to the point where they can be accused of violating those orders, they're supposed to get an attorney before the judge can resort to putting them in detention, to jailing them, as an attempt to control them, kind of a last resort. Now, actually, under federal law, status offenders are not supposed to be jailed immediately. But in 1980, there was a congressional amendment added to federal law that permitted judges to resort to jailing if they went through a process of giving instructions to the child didn't follow the orders, and usually with multiple hearings, eventually was appointed an attorney, if indigent, before any jailing could take place.
Is there any common attribute of the kids who tend to fall into this category? I know that in Knox County, Tennessee, the overwhelming majority of the kids who were in the system were white. Is there any overwhelming kind of common characteristic that they have? Is it mainly that they don't have money?
Yes, most of them are low income, and they also are in families that have some sort of some varying degrees, individual crises going on, whether it's the child having a crisis of some sort, the family, perhaps the family is moving a lot, perhaps they have transportation problems. I spoke to kids who said that they had developed anxiety at school, and sometimes they felt physically unable to leave their house in the morning.
What would you say, though, to those who would argue that these are status offenses that don't follow you into adulthood, so is it really that serious a matter if a kid is adjudicated for something like this that essentially goes away when the person reaches his or her majority, at, you know, 18 or 21? What would you say to that?
Well, actually, it doesn't go away. There are a variety of repercussions and consequences. Some are very concrete. A kid who ends up jailed usually has a delinquency record, too, which is the equivalent of a crime. So in other words, the status offense has been jacked up to a crime. And these records are permanent unless they're expunged. Some of the kids in Knox County didn't even know that they had delinquency records.
As a result of your reporting, what are you seeing? Has there been any reaction to it?
There has been some reaction. As we were reporting, in fact, we contacted the Federal Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, and the Justice Department has become interested in this case. They had received some complaints from lawyers of kids down in Knox County, lawyers who met these kids after they'd been jailed, and the complaints were that these kids were being put into the system and not getting counsel to guide them through, and perhaps look at what was going on at their school and if their school could be doing more for them. Because some of the kids I spoke with had never been tested for special needs, never been offered some sort of alternative plan inside their school to help get them through this time.
Susan Ferris writes for the Center for Public Integrity, and she was kind enough to join us here in our Washington, D.C. studio. Susan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We turn now to an unexpected consequence of getting caught up in the justice system. By now, many people know that getting involved in a criminal proceeding can be expensive, but they're probably thinking about attorney's fees. But what you might not know about, unless you've been there, are the other fees that are increasingly being charged to defendants when they go through court or to prison or receive probation or parole. Fees for things like home detention and probation services, even public defenders, are leaving some poor defendants thousands of dollars in debt. A new NPR investigation found an enormous increase in these types of fees across the country. And NPR investigative correspondent Joseph Shapiro is with us now to tell us more. Welcome back. Thanks so much for joining us,
Michelle.
Once again. What kinds of fees are we talking about? And how did this all start?
How did I get started on this? I started doing some reporting on plea deals. And I was talking to Stephen Bright, who heads the Southern Center for Human Rights. And he said, you should look at this issue of all these fees that pile up on people. He said, we can have people go through the court. They accept the plea deal to avoid time in jail, and maybe it's on some nonviolent misdemeanor. And they sign the plea deal, but they're glad they haven't gone to jail, but they haven't really been paying attention to all the things that are in this deal. And it might be that they some provisions that they have to pay all these fines and fees, and then they can't afford it. They fall behind, and they go to jail anyway.
You go to jail for not paying fines?
Yeah. These can add up to hundreds, thousands of dollars. And when people don't pay, they've violated probation. You violate probation, a warrant's out for your arrest, you can go back to jail. We got the jail records for one county in Washington State, Benton County, Washington. On a typical day, 25% of the people who were in the county jail would come through on the misdemeanor court. 25% of those people were there simply because they had not paid fines and fees.
Your investigation found that defendants are even paying for government services that are constitutionally required, like having a public defender. I mean, I think anybody who's watched a cop show, a police procedural, has seen the Miranda warning. You know, you have the right to counsel, and if you can't afford counsel, one will be appointed for you. So how is it possible that people can be charged for that?
So they say if you can't afford one, one will be provided for you, but you can be charged later. And we did a state-by-state survey. We found 43 states plus the District of Columbia allow a defendant to be charged for a public defender. And sometimes it's just an upfront administrative fee. $10 in New Mexico, up to $400 in Arkansas. But sometimes it's a debt that gets charged for more. And the courts have justified this by saying, look, even poor people can afford something. Maybe it's that small administrative fee. Or maybe they'll get a good job tomorrow, or they'll win the lottery, and you can charge them and they'll owe you for that later. But what we found out when we did this investigation is that sometimes people just say, okay, I won't use a lawyer. And then they get in trouble. They go into court and they don't have a lawyer, or they just carry this debt forever.
You profiled a number of people with different situations, and I want to call attention to the case of Tom Barrett. And this is a story that will be in a future piece in your story, but let's hear a little bit, and then we'll talk about it.
I had to wear this monitor either for 6 months, pay $12 a day for 6 months, or spend 12 months in jail for stealing one can of beer. That didn't seem like justice to me. I mean, I should not have taken that beer. I was dead wrong. But to spend 12 months in jail for stealing one can of beer, I just didn't seem right.
That doesn't seem right. So how did the 12 months in jail come about?
So in this case, he got caught. He is shoplifting. He took a can of beer worth less than $2. And the judge says, all right, that's a minor offense. You can be released. But as a condition, you have to wear an electronic monitoring bracelet. Well, those things are expensive. And he had to pay $12 a day. He had to get a landline phone. He had to pay a private probation agency to supervise him. It was over $400 a month. This guy had been homeless. He just moved into subsidized housing. He was paying $25 a month for his apartment. And he had no income other than food stamps. So $12 a day, he couldn't afford it.
So did he go back to jail because he couldn't pay the fee?
Right. He wasn't paying the fee. And they said, all right, that's a violation of your probation. So they put him in jail. He was actually there for 2 months. His sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous helped him get out. He got out. He had the electronic monitor. He tried to pay, and he fell behind again, and he was faced with going back to jail.
Another person you spoke with is Virginia Dickerson, who is a recovering drug addict who was worried that she would go back to jail because of her fees, and this is what she told you.
I've made the choice to break the law, but they don't make it any easier for anyone who's trying to rehabilitate themselves to get above water. And I'm doing everything that I can, and relapse is not even a thought to me. This is the only thing that is hindering me.
I think the idea that people go to jail for not paying debts, it sounds to me like debtor's prison to many people. And I'm wondering if the jurisdictions where these fines are being imposed, do they understand how big the fines are? And do they understand the impact that they have on people who are already, in some cases, in dire financial circumstances?
Well, I think in our series, we argue they don't understand how much this adds up. States, as their criminal justice system has expanded, they needed money to run it. And states were under pressure not to raise taxes and to keep the budgets balanced. So they passed on more and more user fees to people like Virginia Dickerson. She was in jail. She's had a long history of drug abuse, but she's been sober now for over 3 years. She's got her life back on track. But she came out of prison with $10,000 in debt. And by
for
the way,
what? She came out of prison. How did she have debt being in prison? She had to pay to be in prison?
Her fines and fees, it can be thousands of dollars on one charge. Hers added up to $10,000. Plus, in Washington State, they add 12% interest onto those fines and fees that you owe. She was in prison. She wasn't working. Meanwhile, her debt kept going up and up and up. So when she came out, she had this incredible burden, $10,000 that she had to pay off. And she's done very well now. Just this week, she started a second job. She works in a restaurant. She's got two restaurant jobs. She's trying to pay off the money that she still owes. She's living in a treatment house. She's doing well. But the thing that we just heard in that tape that she's most worried about, it's not whether she'll have a relapse. It's can she pay these fines and fees, all this money she owes? Because if she doesn't, she knows she can be arrested and hauled back to jail.
Some people might argue, two points hearing that, and might have a different reaction. They might argue, one, the system works. If she is afraid of going back to jail for whatever reason, then that is a modification of her behavior. That is an incentive for her to not reoffend. Thing one. And some people also might argue that people have to pay for other government services. Why shouldn't they pay for this one?
We do expect people to be punished, and fines and fees can be an alternative to sending someone to jail. So that can be a good thing, right? But the issue is, are they so disproportionate? Have we created a sort of an unequal system of justice? If you have money, you can pay your fine and fee. You don't get the 12% interest. You pay and it's done. But for someone who doesn't have a job, who's just coming out of prison, $10,000 is crushing. And we also want people to be rehabilitated, to get back on track, to get jobs, to be tax-paying citizens. And if they're constantly in fear of falling behind on their payments and going back to jail, then that's counterproductive.
Presumably you talked to public officials who were responsible for imposing these systems here. So what do public officials say?
We got some mixed reaction. Some judges said, look, the state legislature is out of touch. They don't know the economic situation that people are facing. We're tired of being forced to charge these fees because it's mandated by the state. Some judges said, look, we can only take your time or your money and we need this as a punishment. But in some places now, just in the last few months, there's been some action in state legislatures to try to change this. Colorado just this month passed a law telling municipal judges they can't send someone to jail just because they don't have the money to pay court fees.
Joseph Shapiro is a correspondent on NPR's investigations team. He was kind enough to join us in our studios in Washington, D.C. Joe, thanks so much.
Thank you. It's always good to be here.
To hear all the stories from NPR's Guilty and Charged series, just go to npr.org. Coming up, so you walk into school for your last day and you're greeted by a hallway full of parked cars, a classroom filled with balloons or a goat. It must be senior prank season. Whether you find them hilarious or quirky or just annoying, our next guest says they are more than just childish games. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, with a diagnostic exam and treatment plan for advanced-stage patients seeking a second opinion at cancercenter.com. From the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. From the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org, and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
As a dog handler in the Marines, Jose Armenta's job was to search for IEDs with his dog. On a mission in Afghanistan, Armenta was injured in an IED explosion. He lost both legs above the knees. The dog was not injured and was reassigned to another handler. On the next Fresh Air, Armenta tells us how he was finally reunited with his dog. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Friends of WILL and from Urbana's Market at the Square, happening every Saturday morning, rain or shine, from 7 a.m. to noon at the corner of Illinois and Vine Streets in historic downtown Urbana. Learn more at urbanaillinois.us/market.
Hi, I'm Diane Noland, host of Mid-American Gardener on WILL-TV. This week I'll be joined by guest panelists Chuck Voigt, Kelly Alsup, and Jim Schuster. We'll offer advice for the spring gardening season, and we'll be answering your calls and emails live on the air. Join us for Mid-American Gardener Thursday night at 7 on WILL-TV or listen Saturday morning at 6:30 on AM 580.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now we'd like to talk about an overlooked economic force. We are talking about women. In recent years, a lot of advocates and activists have talked about the global economic importance of educating girls and women, but there's an aspect of this that seems to have been overlooked, and that is the financial education of women. It turns out that women create and influence more than a quarter of the world's wealth, upwards of $20 trillion. In the U.S. alone, women hold decision-making power over more than $11 trillion, and that represents a tremendous opportunity to influence the global economy and society. All this according to a new report titled Harnessing the Power of the Purse, Female Investors and Global Opportunities for Growth. It's by the nonprofit think tank, the Center for Talent Innovation, and the center's founding president, Sylvia Ann Hewlett, co-authored the report. She was also part of Tell Me More's Women in Tech series in March, and she is with us now from London. Thank you so much for joining us once again.
It's great to be part of your show, Michelle.
So what motivated this study?
Really, market failure. Think of this. Of the well-heeled women in the six countries that we looked at, you know, the U.S., the U.K., India, China, Hong Kong, and also Singapore, 53% of these women have no financial advisor because they really don't like what's on offer. They want to talk about how they align their financial resources with the meaning and purpose of their lives. Mm. One of the most amazing interviews in this study is with a young woman called Fiona Krushek. One of these, you know, biomedic entrepreneurs. She started a company when she was 32. She just sold it for 21 million pounds. And she went looking for advice, because she had a very special set of dreams. She wanted to make a difference to women running startups in the biomedic sector. So, you know, she went to the standard kind of financial advisor. He was very patronizing. He saw that she wasn't, as he put it, from money. And eventually she ended up with a woman advisor in a boutique firm who understood that this woman was very serious about, you know, putting her legacy out there.
Let me just unpack a little bit of these details here. You found that 53% of the women surveyed did not have financial advisors, and 75% of the American women under 40, and that 67% of all of these women surveyed felt they were misunderstood by the financial advisors if they did have one. Did you notice any interesting country-by-country differences, any really differences in the ways women in different countries address the question of wealth?
Absolutely. One amazing thing about the U.S. is that women who inherit wealth are incredible philanthropists. That's not so true in China. And that's a very important, you know, not detail, but, you know, piece to grasp. Similarly, women in the UK are actually more confident as investors than US women. And Chinese women are off the charts in terms of their confidence. We find that there is a lot of traditional role playing around money in the US. It's, I think, a product of the 50s. In China, you know, women controlled the silk trade all those years ago. The same is true of traders in Nigeria. They were always women. Mm. So there are parts of the world where women have always been much more comfortable controlling money and making those decisions than is true, you know, in heartland America. And again, that is a fascinating piece of this study.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the way women create and inherit wealth. It's the focus of a new report called Harnessing the Power of the Purse. Our guest is co-author Sylvia Ann Hewlett. This is not a small group of people. You found that 66% of the respondents identified as the financial decision makers in their households. I think that many people would be surprised by that. If they are, in fact, the people making the financial decisions, yet the people who are supposed to be advising them or at least are available for that purposes don't, it sounds like they don't respect them.
Right, and don't get it. Yeah. We find, for instance, that there's a big dichotomy between the women who make their own money and the wives and the widows.
Oh, tell me about that.
And the wealth creators, who are now the majority of women with affluence, really have a very different idea in terms of what they want to do with it. Mm. What we see distinguishes them from men in the same category is this link to their dreams, to their legacies, to the idea that they want to align their life goals with their financial assets. They like performance. They like to do well with their money. I mean, it's not that that is not important. But they also want it to be a vehicle for, you know, meaning and purpose. In some cases, it is altruism. For instance, a lot of women are particularly interested in investing in companies that do very well on diversity, that have women in leadership. They want their values to be expressed in their investments. Others, for instance, have the dream of, you know, supporting girl power or startups. I mean, the dream can be different. Maybe someone has a passion for yoga and want to support, you know, that practice. But whatever the dream is, it needs an expression in your portfolio. And we find in traditional financial services, this is not understood. It's not delivered. And one of the magics of this study, we now know the behaviors, the approaches, the attitudes that women are looking for in their financial advisors.
Does the report speak to whether women are better serving other women? If women are the financial advisors, do they get it?
Well-off women don't care too much whether it's the man or a woman who is actually the advisor. But they want the team to be gender balanced. They want the team and the set of offerings to be infused with what they call gender smarts, an understanding of the female marketplace.
You've interviewed so many people from so many different backgrounds. It just seems odd to me that an industry which is supposedly data driven, right?
Yes.
Which is focused on customer needs,
yes,
doesn't grasp that there are these sources of wealth out there. And doesn't understand that women want to be heard when they talk. I just, can you explain that?
I can. We're discovering that some of the major banking companies, for instance, use a questionnaire that was developed for the Marines to select financial advisors. It's also true that they market to wealthy women all the time, but I think at the back of their minds is this notion that it is the wives and the widows who are pretty passive. So I think what women are yearning for is to be treated seriously, to be treated as professionals, as folks who have created wealth that don't need to be condescended to. Hmm. They also want to be dealt with very efficiently because the last thing professional women have in their lives is a lot of spare time. And it's fascinating, you know, one of the focus groups, we went around the table and several of the very prominent women in the room did not have a financial advisor because, you know, they had felt that the value wasn't there.
May I ask if you have had this experience yourself in seeking financial advice, if it's okay that I ask that as an entrepreneur
no,
yourself?
No, do. I mean...
have you had that experience?
I'm very glad you asked that. I felt a little bit like the poster child today because, you know, clearly I have some assets. I also have a complicated life. I have 5 children. I have a big career. I have no time. But I definitely care about how my assets are allocated. And I have tried 2 or 3 and gotten not very far. It's in very safe places. But last time I looked, for instance, I found that a bunch of the top picks were fast food and defense. Those are not places that I wanted my money to be invested in. So I do feel myself a little frustrated on this front.
What would improve this situation? Different training in what we sometimes call emotional intelligence?
You know, I think empathy, the ability to sit in someone else's shoes, all of this is incredibly important. But what we see at the core here is the yearning for a team of, you know, financial advisors who really do take the diversity of the marketplace these days very seriously and understand that all kinds of new players are driving value in this global economy. And a whole lot of them are not traditional white men.
Do you feel comfortable projecting forward that if women were to be more respected and more aware of their own financial influence globally, how it might change either the economy or our politics. I understand that's a very sort of vast question. I'm just curious if you had thoughts about that.
Well, it's fascinating. For starters, it's a huge engine for growth. Right now, you know, a few $1 trillion are just sitting on the table, a whole lot of them being held in cash because there is no investment of these assets. So that's a bad idea for the global economy. But the other thing that's true, given the thought and the long-run legacy that women want to put into how they allocate their assets, one would think it would be a whole piece of, social energy, which would be enormously good for the, human flourishing in this world.
Sylvia Ann Hewlett is an economist and the founding president of the Center for Talent Innovation. The center released a report today which she co-authored titled Harnessing the Power of the Purse. She was with us from our bureau in London. Sylvia Ann Hewlett, it's a pleasure to speak with you as always. Thank you for joining us.
It was great.
Finally today, let's take a minute to congratulate our graduating seniors. But according to our next guest, we might want to take another minute to congratulate the senior pranksters. They've been busy this year already. Students in Chandler, Arizona managed to park several cars in the school's main hallway. This week, high school students in Northborough, Massachusetts brought a goat and a chicken into school in the middle of the night. It seems that when we hear about these pranks these days, often it's just to wag a finger at the perpetrators for making a mess, for the janitors to clean up. But our next guest, journalist Annie Murphy-Paul, wants us to take another look at it. She says pranks actually require skills like creativity, collaboration, and of course, risk-taking. She's author of the forthcoming book, Brilliant, The Science of How We Get Smarter, and she's with us now to tell us more. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Michelle.
Okay, fess up. Were you a prankster?
I actually was not, and my husband was very surprised that I wrote this article, I must say, because he knows that I am not the kind of person who would ever run a prank or approve of a prank. But I was persuaded by some of the things I read by experts on creativity that actually this can be a way of challenging hidebound rules, a way of bringing people together in a collective enterprise. So I thought it would be something interesting to write about almost because I am definitely not the kind of person who would pull a prank.
Makes sense. But what are some of the favorite pranks that you've heard about in the course of reporting on this?
Well, MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, they're famous there for the pranks that they pull every year. There's even a whole book devoted to their pranks called Night Work. And, they range from parking a police patrol car on top of a giant dome, a building on MIT's campus, to turning another building that had a lot of windows on the front into a giant game of Tetris that they could actually manipulate the colors so that the windows turned and actually play the video game on the building. And then I write, too, about pranks at companies. There's a famous...
Oh, yeah, tell me about that. You were going to tell me about that. And a design firm, apparently.
Right. Yeah. IDEO, which has created a lot of famous kind of iconic products like the computer mouse. They are all about coming up with new ideas that no one's ever thought of before. And so maybe it's not surprising that people who work there bring that playful and innovative spirit to their work. So a boss might go away on vacation and come back to find the door to his office, a sheetrock wall. There was no door, no way to get in. A boss, again, might go out to lunch and come back to find everything on his desk glued down with windshield cement. And I think it's important to note that the pranks are usually pulled by the weak on the strong. You know, it's no accident that it's the boss who's being targeted here. And that's what makes them something other than just a mean or nasty kind of trick. It's an inversion of the power structure. And so that's what makes them interesting and potentially kind of subversive.
Well, yeah, but to that end, though, I mean, the high school senior prank or even the college senior prank, I think more the high school senior prank, often when we hear about it, it's not in a good way. I mean, for example, in Tennessee this year, at least 3 students aren't going to be able to attend their graduation, their high school graduation, because administrators were not pleased that they sprayed cooking oil all over the school floors. I mean, there were a number of kids who were detained, and they were kind of going over the security video to sort of decide who was going to get what level of consequence. They did have to help clean it up, which I think a lot of people would think is fair. So what do you say to people who say, this isn't funny, you're just making more work for other people, generally not yourself, you're defacing property, you're, in some cases you're destroying things, and you know there are school districts where parents have to bring in the paper towels and the crayons because they don't have enough money, so throwing, you know, toilet paper down the, you know, pipes is not funny. It's just not cool. So what do you say to that?
Yeah, well, there's a fine line. I think there's a lot of judgment involved in pranks. Sometimes it's a matter of whether there's a well-loved tradition, as there is at MIT, of pulling pranks, so that it's something that's celebrated and not seen as something destructive, but rather really a proactive kind of pro-social thing where people get together and do this together and pull off these amazing feats. I think when there is that sort of nasty tone to it, or when it is making work for other people, that's where a prank crosses the line into, you know, just bad behavior.
Do you think we're losing something? We only have about 50 seconds left, so briefly, if you would, do you think we're losing something because we seem to be a lot less tolerant of the kind of behavior that used to be kind of laughed off as kid stuff, normal kid stuff a generation ago, but now is kind of seen as a very big deal? Do you think we're losing something?
I think we might be. I mean, we're obviously much more concerned about security these days, but I talk in my article in Time Magazine about on the Time website about a prank that Steve Jobs pulled at his high school graduation. He unfurled a banner that showed a middle finger sticking up. And from all accounts, people laughed and didn't, you know, you can only imagine what would happen to a high school senior if they did that today. But, of course, because it's Steve Jobs, we look back at that and we think, oh, that's an early sign of his his innovative nature.
I'm going to go and get back to my desk to make sure nothing's glued down, okay? Annie Murphy-Paul is author of the forthcoming book, Brilliant, The Science of How We Get Smarter. And she was with us on the line from New Haven, Connecticut. Annie, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.